Down to brass tacks, with us is Dr. Ronnie Yearwood. He'll be sharing the program, the rest of the program with us. And I want to thank Richard Carter, the COVID czar, for coming and spending just over an hour with us to answer some of your questions and to get your feedback one way or the other. This is Down to Brass Tacks.
Sorry.
Yes.
Can I be permitted just one closing statement?
Yes, we lost contact with you for a short period. Yes.
Yeah, okay. All right, so first of all, David, I would like to make an acknowledgement of the fact that there is no infallibility in terms of the COVID-19 response that the government of Barbados has mounted. The government has been open to error just like anyone else, and perhaps at some stages has made errors in terms of how the response has been rolled out. The second thing I want to say is that I fully appreciate and in fact endorse the comment made by Dr. Yearwood in terms of us listening to people because of how persons may perceive the communications that is coming from the government and how policy is actually being delivered on the ground. That is absolutely important for us to do, and we accept constructive criticism because that is how you learn, that is how you do better, that is how you make sure that you're in touch with persons. And one of the reasons why I was keen to come on this program is obviously to hear, as I tend to do, from the average Barbadian in terms of how they're seeing what we are doing. Finally, I'd just like to thank you and obviously Dr. Yearwood and the rest of Barbados for the opportunity to converse with them in terms of some of what we are doing. And we look forward to your continuing support as we mount this effort to save Barbados from further costs, either in terms of lives, livelihoods, or disruption from COVID-19.
Okay, thank you very much, Richard Carter. This is Down to Brass Tacks. Let's take another call. Hello? Welcome?
Hello, Mr. Ellis?
Yes, hi.
Yeah, I'm of the view that government needs to make the wearing of face masks in Barbados mandatory. That's one, and we need some more books on the ground as it relates to personnel doing the actual function of contact tracing. I feel government at this stage, now that we have opened back to commercial airlines, we should at least look to recruit at least 200 persons, volunteers, to be trained as contact tracing personnel to boost the effort. Because I'm of the view that the protocols that we have in place, for example, persons being tested 72 hours from their countries of origin. There's a huge window of opportunity for those people to be infected with the virus after they've been tested. And although they walk into Barbados with a little certification saying they're negative for COVID-19, they may be asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic. And it's going to be problematic for us down the road as it relates to community spread of this virus. So you need more boots on the ground to do contact tracing. Because in my view, the personnel who works in the contact tracing, they were the most significant persons in this fight against COVID. Because if they had done a bad job, Barbados would have had huge community spread. You understand what I'm saying? I give them top marks. They did a great job. But at this stage, now that we are open back to commercial flights, we need more people there to do contact tracing. Not the system is going to become overwhelmed, and we're going to get more deaths. And another point, Mr. Carter had said when he was there that there were no proof that some person contacted the virus from somebody coming in from the U.S. Now, that is persons who had died, they got the virus from relatives coming in from the U.S. who lives in the U.S. You know, 2 weeks before we started doing quarantine from people coming into the U.S., that lady got the virus, and she had diabetic complications.
No, I don't think that you got him right. He spoke about getting it from non-Barbadians. He didn't say that.
But it don't matter if you're dealing with where the people person is living. It ain't got to be
No, sir.
The person is living in the U.S.
No, there are two different issues. Don't come and tell me that they're one and the same. His argument...
Hey, well,
No. His argument, what he said...
The virus.
What he said was that there was no evidence that anybody in Barbados got the virus from a non-Bajan, from what you would call a foreigner. So it was accepted that the virus was transmitted from one Bajan to another. That's what I heard.
Yeah, yes. But what I'm saying, that Bajan live in the U.S., so it doesn't really matter. The person has dual citizenship. They're also, the person is also American. So what is going to say then? It's not like the person gets mumps or measles. We're dealing with the same virus. The person lives in the U.S., and they were allowed to come into Barbados without being quarantined, despite we were seeing what was happening in the U.S. with the higher infestation. We were seeing that on TV, on CNN, and we moved too late to start quarantine. That's why some of those people died. That is my view. We waited too late. Although we seen what was happening in the U.S., we still had the borders open and letting people come in here without putting in quarantine methods in place. Okay? But my view, we need to get more people on the ground doing contact tracing, and we need to make the wearing of face masks mandatory in Barbados.
Okay. Dr. Yearwood, we began on COVID, but I'm sure there are several other things that have been happening in Barbados, and you are likely to have a view, opening thoughts on some of the other developments. What are those developments?
I think one of the important developments, David, and perhaps it's getting lost in discussions about COVID, and we could start a discussion, is the integrity bill that was passed. I believe it was yesterday. Debated in Parliament yesterday, passed, and it's now making its way up to the Senate for debate, which more than likely it will pass there. And you know, for a number of years, we have rightly critiqued successive governments on their lack of action to these things, and perhaps this is one moment where we can give guarded praise until we can see the end of this process, because you know we've been led down this garden path by a previous government who passed the bill but failed to have the Governor General sign the bill, so the bill never became law. We don't expect that to happen here, but I think this is something that we can reflect on, and we can give praise where it's due.
Yes, definitely so, because there are many people who were skeptical that this bill would have gotten so far. I also know that recent comments have been made in public suggesting that the Barbados Labour Party administration needs to make good on this particular promise. Yes. If you heard the comments which were made by Anthony Wood as well. So this is a significant move by the administration, and there, in listening to the debate yesterday, there's a certain degree of haste in trying to deal with it. I did hear the opposition leader call for a bit more time, and the Prime Minister said, but you know, this matter has been under a select committee now for about 2 years, and yes, the opposition leader himself has been involved in that process, and therefore we needed to move along so that we could get this thing in place. I believe they're looking at next year or so, because they have to set up the integrity commission and all of that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And I haven't had a chance, I'll admit, because it's 102 pages to read the final bill that has come from the select committee and what was debated in Parliament yesterday.
You say 102? I heard 800 pages.
I am saying, because I've actually gone to the Parliament website here, mm-hmm, and it's 102 pages for the bill.
But apparently the report was pretty big.
Yeah.
The report was big.
But I'm just looking at the bill here, and in terms of one of the things that struck me was the composition of the actual commission, and in terms of trying to give balance. So for example, when you look at the commission, you have the Governor General has the ability, using their own discretion, to select. Has there two members of the commission are selected by the Governor General outright, it seems. One selected by the Governor General after consultation with the Prime Minister, another by the Governor General on the advice of the Prime Minister, one on by the Governor General on the advice of the Leader of the Opposition, and then one judge by the Governor General on the advice of the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition. So there are 2, 4, 6 persons, it seems, on the commission, and 2 of those persons are on the Governor General's own discretion, and the others are a combination of the Prime Minister and the opposition leader. So I think those should be interesting points, because obviously for the commission to have independence and for it to operate in a manner that people perceive, because it's not only about having independence, it's about the perception. And we keep coming back to this theme today. It's not just about the nature, but people have to also perceive it to be independent, to trust in the process, because that's very important, because we know that over the years, not just in Barbados, this is a problem in politics. Trust has been eroded in our public systems and in public life. And we wouldn't even be here debating and discussing an integrity bill if those systems hadn't been eroded over the years.
Okay, thank you very much. Down to brass tacks. Hello. You're on the air? Hello?
Am I on the air?
You are.
Yes, Mr. Harris, I'd like to make a small contribution. I'm calling from overseas, and I've been calling on for quite a bit. The whole situation, it seems to me, that Barbadians are never satisfied. I'm a Barbadian myself. But I've been away from Barbados for quite some time, and I've learned a lot. And looking back, I can see all the flaws that there is in Barbados. The czar, what you call Mr. Carter, the czar, he is doing a good job. We got a complicated situation. It's either you save life or your economy go under. And what is happening is that it's a certain amount of risk for opening the country. But you can't shut it down forever, or you will never be live. And this is the situation. It's a calculated risk, economy or health. And that is what they're doing. And it's not only Barbados in this situation, we are in step with the whole world. And the World Health Authority is saying what is the protocol, how to go about it, with a little twist here and there with individual countries. The first mask is a tricky one. The first mask, if you're in close contact, if you're a doctor or nurse or something like that, or you're meeting inside of a room, when you're out in the open air, it's not so much, the face mask is not as effective.
Where do
but
you
the
live?
The other thing about the face mask, if you don't put it on properly, or your hands are not clean, and you're taking it off when putting it, you could get contaminated.
Okay.
Just the same.
Where exactly do you live? Which country are you calling from?
I'm in England.
You're in England.
I'm in England, Cambridge.
Yes. And what has it been like for you having to live through COVID in the United Kingdom? Because it's been pretty rough there.
But I tell you my routine. I was locked down for about almost 3 months. And when it was lifted, week ago, I went out to the shop, I come back, I live on my own, and I play a bit of golf, and I come back home, and I don't go nowhere that I learned that is not necessary. From the shop, as I said before, I play a bit of golf. But we're going to have the compulsory wearing of masks from Friday. But that is only into the shop.
You're comfortable with it that way? You're comfortable with it that way, which
but
is
yes,
just wearing it into the shop.
Pointed out to you the science, what it is. It's like a moving target. We never wore the mask in the early stages, but now they got it under control. They're going to wear the mask. As they go along, they're learning more and more about the virus.
All right, sir. Thanks.
It's the disobedience of the barbarian people that is the issue. Mr. Carter's doing a good job.
I must say, in defense of Barbadians, though, that there has been a lot of compliance with the protocols and the rules and the regulations in this country throughout this COVID matter. I sense, and I believe if you have a different view, you can tell me, but I sense that what happened is that there was a degree of relaxation. Once we were defined as COVID-free, people started to react differently. And that relaxation is opening up the possibility that we could have a resurgence of the COVID-19 because of the return of certain flights to Barbados. So in those circumstances, people are worried and they're saying, look, you know, we did a good job of heightening people's awareness. Let us not drop our guard right now. But in general terms, Barbadians have been, I would say, outstanding. I mean, in the period that we had lockdown and that sort of thing, because I'm a media practitioner, I would have had the opportunity to see what was happening, for instance, after 6 o'clock in the evening. It was hardly anybody on the streets. People were really compliant. So what is required here is just a reinforcement of the importance of not letting down our guard completely. It is not as bad as it may appear to some, okay? Thank you very much for your call. This is Down to Brass Tacks. Dr. Yewa, this issue here of how Barbados proceeds with the difficulty of coping with COVID on the one hand and dealing with this economy on the other is particularly significant. This person writes, so people from high-risk countries are given 2 tests 7 days apart, no 14-day quarantine, and we claim to be guided by the science. Even idiots know that the incubation period is 14 days. All right? Why can't we admit that we are operating a compromised protocol with calculated risk that falls just below the threshold of good science for economic reasons? So, if we are to cater to the Barbados welcome stamp, even from high-risk countries, we are down to 7 days. And nobody is explaining to us the rationale for moving from 7 days, from 14 days to 7 days, as the person who has written this points out. So it looks as though, in the interest of trying to get your visitors here and to jumpstart this economy, we're taking a risk. That's what it seems. That's how it seems. Because that's not the science. Not that, based upon all that we've been told in this whole period, that's not the science, not 7 days.
That's definitely a question, I think, for the czar or the minister.
For the ministry and for the government.
The
ministry, I mean, it is
for the government.
It is stark.
To answer. What I would say, though, and perhaps it would be good if we could, that person who wrote the message could have been online so we could have a discussion. What I would say, though, is that it's a tough and it's a difficult choice. And there with anything, even with a 2-week incubation period, we know we're still operating with calculated risk. Everything is a calculated risk. The reality is that there are harsh economic circumstances that we face pre-COVID. We will face them during COVID, and we will face them post-COVID. And I don't envy the government and the choices that it has to make. The reality is it has to make some form and some choices. It will not be able to please everyone. It will not be able to get everything right. But what we do expect is that for questions like this, that there are appropriate responses. And it is a fair question, how we move from a 2-week period to a 1 week period.
Somebody else wanted to know how we move from distancing from 6 feet apart to three. You know, the problem here is that there is so much information that has been made available to people about this thing. And you, on the one hand, you're being told to be cautious, do this, do that, do the next. And on the other hand, it seems as though the very things that you're being advised to do are being undermined by a different approach because of the desire to jumpstart the economy. And we understand that there is that argument that says, look, if you don't get this economy started, people won't die from COVID, but they will die from starvation. We need jobs. So we are caught on the horns of a dilemma.
Yeah, it's between, I wouldn't even say a rock and a hard place. It's just between a rock and a rock. And in these circumstances, some of the government's approach, for example, the welcome stamp, is a brilliant idea. It's a good idea. The speed in which it was rolled out, we should give credit and praise there. But there are obviously valid questions in terms of that balance and whether we're getting the balance right between trying to restart our economy and protecting the lives of people. I think the Prime Minister has phrased it as about livelihoods and lives, and there is value to that. We have to think, how are we going to protect people's lives, but at the same time, how are we going to create an environment for them to be able to still maintain some livelihood, to feed their families, and we have to probably think more. We have the next 6 months to get through, and then we have to probably factor in another six for next year. So we've got another 12 months of this particular situation, and it's not just Barbados. Obviously, it's a global situation. So let me give you a personal example. So we have reopened the borders in terms of acceptance, in terms of traveling for tourists. I have a friend of mine who was thinking about coming to visit, but still can't get here because of the nature of flights and trying to leave and travel through, whether it's the US or Canada. So sometimes things are, that just goes to show, things are still beyond our control. We may be doing one thing, but there are persons coming from other parts of the world still may not be able to get here. So these are all the difficult situations that we face. We're acting in an environment where we are not controlling many of the factors that we would like to control. It's not perfect, and it's a hard one. But that does not stop us from asking these types of questions, and the one that the person just posted, in terms of whether we are taking a calculated risk. And perhaps we need to bring on the Ministry of Health officials here to walk us through that particular calculated risk and how they arrived at that decision.
Okay. Down to brass tacks. Hello.
Hi, David.
Yes.
Hi, I have a question to ask, right? Because I realized, okay, this is the government, everybody doing a really good job, the Barbadians obeying and adhering to the rules and stuff like that. I respect that. I like it a whole lot. It's really good, right? But the question I got to ask is water and soap versus hand sanitizer?
Well, that's something that's one of the people who, one of the doctors or so, would have to answer for you.
Because let me give you an example, right? Let me give you an example. I go to a particular wholesale place in Barbados, right? When you get out the door, there's a foot, you know, there's a foot operated pipe, and there's soap, and there's a blow dryer there. So it's right by the entrance, and when you get ready to go inside, they can see that you use the hands, and they see that you wash your hands with soap and water and dry your hands with the air dryer, and then you come inside, right? So they don't have to spray you. That is much healthier than alcohol on your skin consistently every place that you go. I mean, it's killing the good bacteria on your hand that's supposed to fight off the whatever sicknesses that come your way. Your hands get really dry and start to get really itchy. But soap and water then can happen, and soap and water is by far safer than hand sanitizer.
Well, if I were to look at what is being said and what I've heard, the first option is supposed to be soap and water. But you know, you don't necessarily have soap and water everywhere. So,
but I have soap and water everywhere I go.
Well, you may you may have it, but I see here the best way to prevent the spread of infections and decrease the risk of getting sick is washing your hands with plain soap and water. And this is the advice coming from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the United States. Mm-hmm. It says that washing hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds is essential, especially after going to the bathroom, before eating, and after coughing, sneezing, or blowing one's nose. If soap and water are not available, CDC recommends consumers use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol.
All right, let me show you something that I encounter. I pull up at a supermarket. The person that is spraying can see me washing my hands with soap and water from a tap, projecting from my vehicle, right? They see me close the vehicle with my foot. My hands are still dry. My hands are still wet. I walk up to the door, and they started to, like, you know, I said, well, you know, you just saw me wash my hands. But, like, you know, if you don't want nobody to see, if we do the wrong thing, I can't shut down the supermarket. Because, you know, the Zara said they can shut down places, and they can put fines on people. So I was like, but you just see me wash my hands and stuff, and what is the common sense thing? But I can't keep noise with her because that is the directive that she got. So I think that people should be trained properly in this thing.
I think it's just also a matter of practicalness. The reality is nobody's gonna have, you know, sir, you may have soap and water, and you know that's very fortunate that you are able to do so. But I'm sure, David, I don't think that we walk around with soap and water in the back of our vehicles, or people who walk around with soap and water.
The fellas who sell snow cones, I mean, from the back of the truck or the back of the car, but I don't think that we do.
Yeah, exactly. For practical reasons, you can see why you need hand sanitizer, or they spray your hand at the door. You know, the first choice, as we just read out, is soap and water, but when you are out and about, that can't happen for most people, I would say for most of us. So I don't really see any harm or any issues here. You get your hand sprayed or you have your hand sanitizer and you follow the protocols and you move through with your business.
Okay, well, Dr. Ronnie Yearwood is our guest today.